Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the House of Assembly Chamber. I'm Josh Teague, and I'm recently re-elected member for Hyson, and I sit over on the opposition benches in this place when the Parliament's sitting. It's a tremendous thing to see this chamber filled by so many former members. Members of this place and also members of the Federal Parliament. We're going to have the great pleasure of hearing from three of the more prominent among us in just a moment. But so many of you who've joined us, I hope that this evening is enjoyable and instructive and inspiring in ways as we step through another stage of our state's history by examination of the Bannon years. I want to start by, with reference to Standing Order 39, which is not so very long, part of our standing orders, but is referred to at the commencement of every sitting day and immediately after the prayers. We acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the traditional owners of this country throughout Australia and their connection to land and community. We pay our respects to them and their cultures and to elders both past and present. Now, there are some couple of mundane matters of housekeeping. There are bathroom facilities in this building, not very many. It was one of the criticisms of the architects. If you require them, seek out the assistance of the staff who will help you by first heading towards the doors at the rear. And in the unexpected case of an emergency, we might be fortunate to have some announcement on the public address, but otherwise make your way to the back and follow instructions as well. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm the president of the Australasian Study of Parliament Group, the SA chapter, the famous SA chapter, and the ASPG holds a number of events, at least three each year in the interests of the study of Parliament. It's a political non-partisan body and, of course, focused on encouraging and stimulating research and writing and teaching and discussion about our institutions of Parliament. All events are free for ASPG members. Tonight's a free event. We have others where there's a nominal charge, but free to members, and you're encouraged to join the ASPG and fully participate through the year, and if you'd like to take up some expression of interest with me or with the staff who are here tonight. Now, tonight's event is one of real significance. We're reflecting on the Bannon years. I want to welcome in particular tonight Angela Bannon and members of the family and friends who are here as well. As I've mentioned already, I especially recognise that there are, apart from the panellists, many former members of this place who will be finding it familiar to return to their seats. I want to welcome in turn each member of the panel, all three of whom, and I recognise on her arrival, Madam Speaker, the Honourable Nat Cook, who's joining us tonight and might find a seat. There's room up the front here, Nat, if you like. Oh, well, you know, there's room up the front. the Honourable Don Hopgood AO, who was a member of this place from 1970 to 1993, and notably relevantly was Deputy Premier to John Bannon from 85 to 92, I think. Don served in a whole variety of portfolios, education, environment, health, community welfare. I note in particular, as is known in the community in the South, the Hopgood Theatre at Noarlunga is named in his and his wife Raylene's honour, and that's in recognition of their extraordinary substantial community work and support of the arts. And from my point of view, I also want to single out Don's very thoughtful, thorough engagement on electoral reform matters that I've had some occasion to reflect on over recent years. Secondly, the Honourable Chris Sumner AM is here with us on the panel. Chris was a member of the Legislative Council from 1975 to 1994, and in the course of that very lengthy service became South Australia's longest serving Attorney General and was Attorney from 82 until 93, so the entirety of that period. He led the Labor Party in both government and opposition in the Legislative Council and he then went on for 17 years, I think, afterwards as a member of the National Native Title Tribunal. And I single out in respect of Chris's work, continues to be very active publicly, but he was a pioneer in terms of reforms for victims' rights, and the 1985 reforms in particular stand out. Thirdly, the Honourable Greg Crafter AO, who was a member of this place from 1979 to 1993 as member for Norwood, and also held a large number of portfolios during that time. They included education, community welfare, Aboriginal affairs, housing and local government, and since leaving politics, he's remained also leading in his public engagement, and particularly the National Catholic Education Commission as its chair. And I'm going to hand over, and for the duration of the evening, to our esteemed facilitator for tonight, Mike Smithson. Mike, somewhat pejoratively, I feel, is often described as a veteran journalist and broadcaster, but I think that that's a sign of respect for Mike's leading role in public life as a journalist in South Australia. He's a former bureau chief for a national current affairs program. He's been an international correspondent. He's been SA Journalist of the Year. And as we all know, he's currently a regular upfront presenter at Channel 7 and can be heard almost every day on the ABC or 5AA, and if you're not reading his work, in the In Daily. So he's a ubiquitous presence, and particularly, given his veteran status, going all the way back to the period that we're concerned with. I'll hand over to Mike in just a moment. In the lead-up to tonight, I was taking my own mind back to remind myself just who won the 1986 Adelaide Grand Prix and how did Alain Prost do that in what I can't believe was 40 years ago, and as well reflecting on the 40 years celebration of the Maralinga Jaratja Land Rights Act of 1984, which was commemorated in the course of last year. Actually, the Minister and I both attended on that occasion, a proud achievement of the Bannon era, about which we might hear a little bit more along the way tonight. So much to go on with. Without further ado, I'll hand you over to Mike Smithson.
Thank you very much, Josh, and I also pay my respects to the traditional owners on the lands we meet. And, Madam Speaker, congratulations. I don't think I've had a personal opportunity to congratulate you on your ascension to the chair and also to the ASPG. Now, as Josh said, I was around in 1979. I'd only just started in television back in those days, but let me take you back. Let's just set the scene, if I may. The day John Bannon rode into town as a serious contender capable of winning back government from the Tonkin government in 1982. Well, it seems like a hell of a long time ago, because it was. So let's cast our minds back 44 years and beyond to South Australia and the political climate. The Dunstan years had passed us by with considerable flair and reform. Don had departed politics, draped in that infamous dressing gown and aided by a walking stick, very theatrically, at Calvary Hospital in February 1979. David Tonkin and the Liberals won power that year against Des Corcoran and Labor with 55% of the two-party vote and a swing of more than 8%. Labor had lost 8 seats, but the Libs still only had 25 of the 47 seats right in this House. It gave them a buffer of 1 seat from the 24 required for majority government, but that was soon to change. The Court of Disputed Returns ordered a by-election in Liberal 1 Norwood, and Labor's Greg Crafter was resurrected back into office. Congratulations. I don't think I've congratulated you since way back then, Greg. Great effort. Des Corcoran had stepped aside with a little nudging, I'm told, after what was seen as the disastrous decision to call the early election in 79, which had allowed the Libs back in. Dunstan was furious at Des because Des had blown it, in Don's words, and perhaps part of Don's own legacy as well. So Bannon emerged. He was young, polite, polished, confident, and with an academic background. He was much closer in style to Dunstan than any others. Des was damaged goods, and the other leadership possibility, Hugh Hudson, well, he didn't survive the massacre of 79. So John Bannon, the right time, the right person, and a man for all seasons. So before we knew it, the 80s had arrived and the looming 1982 election, a new approach for sleepy Adelaide, what was to come, or as we've heard, the Formula One race, the Adelaide Casino, the Hyatt Hotel, the ACER project, which covers the whole of the environment around the railway station, poker machines, Collins class submarines, Olympic Dam, the Maya REM project, the will it or won't it multifunction policy, can forget that. Even the Queen mentioned that on her last visit here, and concluding, sadly, with the state bank collapse. Here's an extract about a time in global history. See if you can pick it. And I quote, "A tightening of monetary policies by the United States and other developed nations. This was exacerbated by the Iranian situation, which saw oil prices sharply rise. That rise in oil has pushed the already high interest rates of inflation in several major advanced countries. Central banks are tightening monetary policies by increasing interest rates in order to control inflation." Sound familiar? Well, no, it's not 2026, it's the early 80s. Olympic Dam legislation passed in March 1982 under the Tonkin Libs with the help of Labor renegade MLC, or hero, whichever way you want to look at it, Norm Foster. He quit and then he was banished to the crossbench of his own accord. But that appeared to put Bannon in the crosshairs as Labor fundamentally opposed uranium mining. Some might disagree with that, but that's how history as I see it records it. The stakes were high. Bannon knew it. It was facing the voters just 8 short months later. But as Labor always says, and usually very successfully, it's time after only one Liberal term. It sounds familiar too, doesn't it? Bannon gained an almost 6% swing and won 4 seats from the Libs. The Libs via the Honourable Stephen Baker. I'm not sure if he's here tonight. Stephen, if you're here, wave your hand. No, he's not. He won back Mitcham from the Democrats, but that still meant only 24 seats for Labor in its own right, the barest majority. And by the way, it got trickier. 2 years later, a by-election saw independent Labor candidate Martin Evans win from Labor after sitting Labor MP Peter Duncan went to Canberra in Elizabeth. So by then, the minority government of 23, but with 2 Labor independents on side. But staying on track with 82, in the Legislative Council, the Libs were, well, notionally in charge with 11 seats to Labor's 9, and the Democrats had 2. By the time the writs were returned on the 4th of December 1982, John Bannon had an emerging world before him, as they say, plenty of work to do. David Tonkin departed and was replaced by John Olsen, who won a leadership ballot against Dean Brown. This is where we will pick up the story with our three guests. All are eminent in their own right, as Josh has pointed out. I won't go over their credentials because you've heard them. They all shape the fortunes of the South Australian Labor Party and of South Australia itself. And can I say on a personal note, it's quite humbling, very humbling to be here tonight as an observer of politics, but in awe of those who actually pulled the levers and made the decisions, not just back then, but from then onwards. I've sat up there for hours, days, weeks on end, never spoken from the floor, so it's a great privilege. A lot easier up there, I can tell you. So let's lift the lid on some home truths where John Bannon's glittering early years just fool's gold as the decade progressed. The Honourable Chris Sumner, I'll start with you, and I'll ask all three of our guests tonight where they see they fitted in to that era, perhaps pre-Bannon, but certainly during the 80s, the Bannon 80s. Just, I'm not saying what is your legacy, but what you would like to be remembered for. Chris, we'll start with you.
Well, I think when we came into government, there was a feeling that for the period of the 80s, we'd let the Dunstan image down. We're not a mainstream social democratic party, not a Labor Party in the sense that Dunstan was. Well, no one was going to be like Don Dunstan. It was impossible to replicate him. No one attempted to. But my thesis would be that we actually continued as a mainstream social democratic party during the 80s, and in my era of law reform, that I'd like to think that stacks up. So I'll just run through a few points. There were some things not done by the Dunstan government. One was the prohibition of discrimination on the basis of sexual preference. Now, most people think Don did that, but he didn't. And in fact, he had recommendations to do it and didn't do it. We made sexual harassment a ground of discrimination. We appointed Elliot Johnston QC to the Supreme Court. The Dunstan government had a ban on him because he was a member of the Communist Party. We appointed the...
Can't hear. Microphone a bit closer.
Somewhere.
Would you like to come up here, Chris? Would that be easy?
Well, I don't mind.
Yeah, why not?
Sorry about that. Anyhow, the last one was we appointed Elliot Johnston as a communist, and that was something Don Dunstan, the Dunstan government never did. We appointed the first woman CEO, Crown Solicitor, and Crown Solicitor Catherine Branson, who's just retired as Chancellor of the University of Adelaide. She was, I recommended her at the age of 36. The Dunstan years couldn't find a woman to be head of a department in South Australia, which all may seem surprising. We fully criminalised at least rape in marriage. That had only been partially done by the Dunstan government. We rewrote liquor licensing laws in 1985, and that actually permitted the outdoor cafe society that we now enjoy. Don wanted to do it to some extent. He did a lot of changes in liquor licensing laws, but the process was too bureaucratic. In 1985, we completely rewrote the liquor licensing laws, took out the requirement for need for a new liquor licence, and it was from then on that the cafe society really, really took off. So in that sense, I think we continued what the Dunstan initiatives and built on them. I suppose the main ones of our own that we moved on with was, well, first of all, very important. We had a Royal Commission into the conviction of murderer Eddie Splatt. That conviction was overturned, and it led to the establishment of the Independent Forensic Science Centre, separating the police from the collection and analysis of forensic evidence. That Forensic Science Centre, I think, was one of the first in Australia, followed the Lindy Chamberlain problems, as we know, in the Northern Territory. Very rarely mentioned, but I think it was a very significant thing that we did. Victims of crime has been mentioned. There's no doubt that we're ahead of the pack in that. First Declaration of Victims' Rights in 1985, victim impact statements, a levy on offenders, a victim of crime fund. We increased compensation so comprehensive that even victims of the Bali bombing, for instance, South Australians, were entitled to get compensation for the injuries that occurred. Now, just to contemporise that, that fund now has $250 million in it. Can you believe that? The government certainly doesn't tell you that. It gets $27 million in each year. But it's not used for victims, it's used by Treasury to balance the books. But I think in that area we definitely had an important role to play. Community crime prevention, imprisonment is a dead end. You can't just rely on police corrections to deal with offending. You have to look at causes of crime. You have to involve the community. We had a Together Against Crime policy, it was funded, involved the community, support for community groups, support for groups that could, for instance, look after young people for situational crime prevention and the like. It was scrapped by the RAND government. And, of course, the tragedy now is because the imprisonment has increased and continues to increase, the Aboriginal deaths in custody have also increased. So nothing's been done about it, despite the promises that have been made. We moved on multicultural policies, and again, I won't go into them. Multiculturalism is for everyone, not just for migrants. And we were said to be, in the Bannon Decade book, to be able to plausibly claim a number of pioneer achievements in that area, which led to the Hawke agenda for multicultural Australia. Electoral Act 1985, completely rewritten, 4-year terms, enhanced the franchise. Importantly for the current debate, we introduced for the first time in Australia truth in political advertising, which was recently described as a model for Australia by the Centre for Public Integrity. And it needs something in this area to be looked at. How can a democracy survive if there can be no truth in the way politicians go about making their promises and making their statements in this post-truth, post-fact world? It's actually central to where we stand at the moment. We dealt with that in 1985 Electoral Act. Very quickly, integrity in government. Independence of the judiciary, magistrates taken out of the public service, an independent courts administration authority, declaration of members' interests was introduced, freedom of information legislation, whistleblowers, privacy principles, an enhanced committee system in the parliament, a code of conduct for ministers, and I actually put on the table a code of conduct for members of parliament. And it took about 4 years ago for them to actually act on that in this parliament. So abolish the police special branch and put in an operations intelligence section with an auditor to oversight police surveillance of terrorist type activities or violent activities or political activities that were violent or potentially violent, but not those that were non-violent. That followed the Salisbury Royal Commission. And we introduced the Director of Public Prosecutions, subject to the direction of the Attorney-General, again, an independent prosecution service. So that's a pretty quick summary from where I stand. I think it was a reasonable set of continuing reforms in the Labor tradition that had been started by Dunstan. If you want to say what probably stood out, perhaps ahead of the pack. Don't like hubris, but I think the victims of crime area was the one that I would point to. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Chris. Very comprehensive indeed. The late Jill Bottrell always said to me, and she was Chris's media advisor, he's the most brilliant person she's ever met. Certainly wasn't me, I can tell you. But anyway, Don Hopgood, tell us a bit, What do you want to be remembered for going forward?
Probably the Native Vegetation Act. However, I need to expand on that.
Yes, yep.
1979 was interesting and important because, of course, we'd lost all the old men. All the guys that ran the Parliamentary Party were gone for one reason or other. So you were back to some of the people in middle life. And if you had somebody who'd already been there for 10 years, well, maybe this fellow had a little bit in him anyway. And that's the person who's talking to you right now. I can remember going to talk to John about portfolios because we'd gone into opposition with me as Minister of Education. I didn't really want to go back to that. I don't think anybody else wanted me to either. And... I had a particular interest in the planning and environment. And John Cornwall had looked after that for us, but he was headed for health, so what to do? So I had this meeting with Bannon, and I said to him, John, I really would like the environment and planning portfolio. I think I understand the Planning Act. And Bannon, who had a sense of humour, said, well, Don, if you do, you're the only one in the Parliament who would be able to. But, yes, I'd spent most of the previous 10 years reading up and having experience in environmental and in planning matters. So I was able to bring that, for good or ill, to the government with, as I say, all of the giants gone and we younger people now more or less in charge. And the other thing I want to say about is this. One of the most important things about me as a minister was the support I got from the Cabinet. See, if I can mention David Wattenbrock, a lovely guy, David, lovely guy, say nothing against him, and he had a few ideas and so on, but he couldn't get them parties through his Cabinet. And we came in and just did it. If you're talking, for example, about adding to the national parks area, and we put an enormous amount of stuff under national parks, then it's a case of easy in, hard out. If you wanted to clear an area as a national park, you simply put it in the Gazette and it's done. If you want to undeclare it, you've got to get it through both houses of Parliament. So easy in, difficult out. And we put an enormous amount under reserve. And I can remember the Governor, Oliphant, saying on one occasion at Executive Council, there are a lot of these have come through, Mr Premier. And John Bannon, again, with his sense of humour, said, my minister is interested in turning the whole of the state into a national park, except the City of Adelaide, and that will become a heritage area. Gross exaggeration, but we knew what he meant. We knew what he meant. So that was the area in which I was... That's what I think I brought to the Cabinet as much as anything else.
Thank you very much, Don. How about a round of applause? Don was almost my year 8 teacher at Westminster, but he had gone by the time I got there. He taught my brother, though. Still speaks very highly of you. Greg Crafter. Well, we've already gone through that by-election. Maybe you'd like to just refresh us a bit on that and tell us about your achievements.
Well, I'm trying not to think about having...
Just turn the mic, if you can, a little
how's
bit.
How's that? Is that better?
Yeah, as close as you can get. That's it.
Yes, I entered Parliament when Don Dunstan resigned at the beginning of 1979, and some 6 months later, Des Corcoran called the election that Mike has referred to, and I lost the seat of Norwood by 33 votes and went to a court of distributed returns. Roma Mitchell was the judge, and Ted Mulligan was my counsel, and he said to me, I've got a good and up-and-coming junior to help you. His name is John Doyle, who later became the Chief Justice. So I had a pretty competent council and we won a fresh election and I then subsequently won that election. So we had 3 elections in 11 months and we had our second child a week before the third election. So I have quite a vivid memory of that period, but I don't think anyone's been through that in their political career. I just want to say that one of the great privileges of my life was the 10 years that I spent in the Bannon Cabinet and working with John Bannon, who is just an outstanding individual, the character of the man and his achievements in part before he went into Parliament, when he was in Parliament and afterwards are really just something extraordinary. And so it was a great privilege. I had 11 budgets in my career, every one of them, they were harder and harder as you went on to manage through. But I had great support from, great friendship, camaraderie from John. We would sit all night sometimes, 5 o'clock in the morning, walk past John's office to go home, and there he was putting on his running shoes to run back to Prospect, 5 o'clock in the morning. I was just heading for bed as quickly as I could. The things that I'm proudest about of our government that I think are enduring, there are 3 things that I think are outstanding. One is that John Bannon's ability to provide the leadership to ensure that Roxby Downs was developed as a mine. And today, and we didn't know then, but we now know much more about how rich that mine is and how important it's going to be for the future prosperity of this state, and particularly the development of Eyre Peninsula, the steelworks revival, renewal in Whyalla, the issues about infrastructure for getting water and transport and other facilities for not just mining, although there are many junior miners in that area, but for our grain industry, for fishing and aquaculture, and for tourism. So I think that Roxby Downs was an enduring thing that was quite a feat to get that policy changed, not only at the state level but the federal level as well. The submarine contract, I think now we realise, we didn't at that time, but just how important this is. It's one of the largest industrial enterprises in this country today, and is going to just continue, obviously, to grow and grow. And we are the centre of that in this country. Thirdly, the Formula One Grand Prix. You may not think that that was a feat, but it brought Adelaide onto the global market, really, and to show that we could not only do that, but do it to be the best in the world. And it gave, I think, us the impetus to see Adelaide in a different light. The legislation was bitterly opposed in this House. I was there on that bench, and I night after night we argued about that. We got it through, and I think we can now see just how important events are. Maybe there's a limit to how many we can have in Adelaide, but it is part of our economy. There are five new hotels being built in Adelaide at the moment, and so I see those as very far-sighted developments, and none of us would have seen where they really headed. Of my own portfolio, the most major issue I think that I'd like to be remembered for is the Maralinga land rights claim and all surrounding that. It is unbelievable to think that in the 1950s, atomic bombs were detonated here in South Australia, and the impact of those is still present. Uranium has the remnants of those explosions has a half-life of 250,000 years. And to get that cleaned up accurately was a huge challenge. But it was the Royal Commission, the McClelland Royal Commission, that really uncovered 13 tonnes of evidence from the United Kingdom. I was in John Bannon's office when we were talking to Jim McClelland, the former federal minister, about the Royal Commission. And we said to him, will you go to London and try and dig up this evidence? And he said, no, I won't be going to London. And we said, why not? He said, it's far too cold. And anyway, he went to London, and he was there for over a year. And that's where they really discovered, what really happened, because not many people in Australia really knew what on earth was going on. And we had a very important select committee which uncovered really important evidence about what happened at that time and its impact in the communities. And then to get the legislation through Parliament, incredibly difficult because we didn't have a majority in the upper house, and the work of Arthur White, who lived on Eyre Peninsula, was invaluable in getting that legislation through the Parliament. Then the clean-up, the British government had to clean up, and they had to pay compensation as well. So I think that chapter in our history was one of reparation and great sadness, really. People have gone back, repatriated back onto the lands now, Oak Valley and places, and are much happier than they were in Yalata, which was where they were really forced to go. But many were put on trains. They were going east, they went to Port Augusta and other places. If the train was going to the west, they went to Kalgoorlie and other places, and families were broken up. It was a terribly sad thing. The other issue that I'd like to be remembered for, I probably won't be, is in the education portfolio. We were very worried about a number of employment practices. 25,000 people are working in the department, 15,000 teachers, and principals in the primary schools were appointed not on the basis of merit but on seniority. And so really, there was a list, and you were on that list for years, and if you wanted to get to Walkerville Primary School or Norwood Primary School, you just sat on the list until you got it. That women in the previous generation had to resign when they married or became pregnant. And so women were denied, really, getting seniority. And so we didn't have any women, or very few, who spinsters, really, who could actually take on principalships through that non-merit process. And so we introduced merit appointments in primary schools and for deputies as well. And it was a pretty tough time. But it's meant now, and I look back, that so many women, very talented women, are providing that leadership in our schools. And I think that's an enormously important... You know, you think of the importance of primary education and how important it is to provide that leadership in our primary schools in those years. So I'd like to be remembered for that, but I'm probably not. But certainly Maralinga, I think a lot of people know about that.
Thank you very much. Greg Crafter. Chris, I might get you to join me up here only because the flashing green light... Flashing green light in this place is not a good sign. Red is good, flashing green, not good. So, if you could come up and share the microphone here. Look, I'd like to get the ball rolling, and I know we're starting early 1982 here. Olympic Dam, which we've touched on. The Liberal Premier at the time, David Tonkin, advocated mining and the Olympic Dam indenture agreement. Its passing in the LegCo came down to one man, Labor's Norm Foster. Foster wasn't convinced uranium mining was an environmental or ethical scourge that some others did. And on the day before the final vote on the project, he resigned from the Labor Party. Chris, if you were part and parcel of this, and I'll ask everyone... various questions, but if you'd like to come up here and stay here, are you all right?
Yeah, sure.
How tense did it become in the days and hours before the final vote? What was the atmosphere like? I know you probably weren't here at the time, and Don will get the same question, but just as folklore has it... Oh, you were in the other house, of course. What were the feelings at that time?
How long have you got?
These are rapid-fire questions.
Oh, okay.
Chris, well, 2 minutes.
Yeah, no. Well, they are incredibly tense. But the problem was that State Labor Party had a federal policy that had been in existence for a good 8 years, totally against uranium mining. We could not proceed unless we bucked the party. Impossible to do. So we had a strategy of opposing it, but trying to oppose it in a responsible way, select committee, adding some amendments to the bill, etc., and expected that our policy would mean that it would be defeated. Now, Norm, and a great Australian, a rat of Trabuk, a great friend of mine, really started to have serious doubts about whether we should oppose the bill. But he was in the party. That was the party policy. The problem was for about 12 months before the actual vote in 1982, Norm would give speeches at state convention and you weren't quite sure where he stood on it. He would say one minute, well, I'm really going to support this legislation because I feel I should. And then he would say, no. He was very, very conflicted about it all. And only a week or so before this vote came on, he made a very similar speech. And so the vote comes on, the atmosphere was incredibly tense. As it turned out, he initially came, after all that background, he actually supported Labor and opposed the bill. And then the next morning, the Liberal Party spoke to him. He changed his mind, resigned from the Labor Party, and then the bill went through. Norm, as I said, had a genuine concern about this. Our problem trying to deal with the issue was that we wanted to low-key the issue, we wanted to put the party's position against uranium mining, but it became a brouhaha. It was just a major a public debate, which everyone can... And in the chamber itself, it was incredibly tense. Now, had we not changed the national policy, then we were going to lose the election. That was clear. We were told that by our polling. The pollsters also, I think, told Hawke government that unless you change the uranium policy, you won't get through. So that John Bannon had to go to the national conference, yes, and the policy was changed. And it was changed to the so-called Three Mines policy, which included Roxby Downs and Ranger and I think Honeymoon. Now, don't expect me to explain the logic of a three mines policy, because there is absolutely no logic to a three mines policy. It is a political compromise that enabled the Hawke government to go ahead a couple of months after us and support uranium mining, and it enabled us to go to the 82 election supporting in particular Roxby Downs, and we knew had we not done that, then we would not have won the election.
Thank you, Chris. Don, from where you sat, first of all, how was caucus at that time? Was it pretty tense if Norm was in the room leading up to the time? And secondly, was John Bannon really a closet supporter of uranium mining deep down, or did he have to be convinced?
No, I don't think so. I think he had to be convinced. Look, Norm, I support what Chris says about Norm, a great fella, but he would bring tension to the caucus. There's no doubt about it. And that made things rather more difficult. So far as I was concerned, this is the important stuff was happening there in the Legislative Council. And I would get on doing what I was doing. And whichever way it went, we would work through it. So maybe I was rather a bit too cool over the whole thing, but that's how it was.
Greg, from where you sit, and I realise I'm looking back retrospectively. I guess you can't look forward retrospectively, can you? But anyway, I'm looking back. Was Norm a hero, or was he just... Is he a bit of a villain? Or was he a bit of a villain?
No, he was a very thoughtful man. And he had been in the federal parliament. He had that experience, and he then came into the Legislative Council. I had many conversations with him over the years, and used to door knock in that Sturt electorate that he had. He was a person capable of reflecting seriously on these issues. He came to a decision, as Chris said, that he prevaricated over for a while and then made that decision. And I think when you look at that time, there was a different approach in our community towards uranium, and particularly the proliferation of weapons and control over that. There was real concerns. I think we've passed that period to a large extent.
What would have happened if he hadn't crossed the floor? Where would we be at today?
I think we would have still worked through that political process and got to where we wanted to get. But that legislation wouldn't have passed in the Legislative Council. It was Roxby Downs was owned by a different set of companies. It was owned by Western Mining and BP. Mm-hmm. And then it changed to BHP, and that they brought a different concept altogether to that mine. The announcement that John Bannon made that we were going to approve of Roxby Downs and the mining there was made at a policy speech at Channel 9 out at North Adelaide before that election. And I was sitting alongside of Peter Duncan, actually, and I could see Peter levitating as he was talking.
Oh, well, it should have been at Channel 7, that's all I can say. Now, moving on, in my opinion, I'm glad to argue the toss, but I think, as we've discussed, the F1 was the shining star which grabbed the public attention during this decade, cast our minds back. In the early 80s, F1 boss Bernie Eccleston started looking for a new city to add to the Grand Prix schedule. He wanted to expand into markets outside Europe and find an exciting street circuit. There had been talk of an Australian city hosting it for a while, but it was only Adelaide that really went for it. We have my former news director, Terry Plain, who's sitting in the audience tonight, was actually at the meeting with John Bannon and Bernie Eccleston. That's not a state secret, is it, Terry? No. No, I didn't think it was. That Adelaide really went for it, hungry to secure a world-class event that would help shake off perhaps an image of a dull city. Don, I'll start with you. What do you reckon the implications for Adelaide were? Because I have read you weren't exactly a motor racing buff.
Not at all, not at all. But I could see how important it was. And we know from the succession of these sort of events that have happened down the years how important they are to South Australia. But I want to say one thing. Another aspect of the whole thing was the committee that ran Jubilee 150. Because there were a number of people on there who were in a position to be able to give considerable assistance to the Grand Prix idea. One was the Lord Mayor, who said, we will organise the treatment of the streets, our works program, in such a way it will give favour to where the Grand Prix is actually going to run.
Smart move.
Yeah. So that was important. And, of course, it was a very representative sort of a committee. It had originally been set up by the Liberals, I think, in government. And now, of course, we'd been in government for some time and putting our own stamp on it. But that was important.
Thanks, Don. Greg, was this period a sign that John Bannon was a visionary, a risk taker, or he just wanted Adelaide to have a bloody good time?
Not at all. I think there was a lot of thought went into this. It did come out of Kim Benithan chaired the Jubilee 150 committee.
Just close to the microphone if you can, Greg.
Kim Benithan chaired the Jubilee 150 committee. He obviously had a background in motor tourism and sports and so on. There was a number of people who came to the government, I know, talking about the possibility of achieving Formula One event. You know, this is an event where there's a press gallery of 5,000 that travel around with this event around the world. It is the big game. I must say that the story that John Bannon told us when he came back from England, he had had a conversation with Bernie Eccleston, who ran Formula One, owned it, and Eccleston said, look, I've got your letter and we are interested in doing a deal with you. He said, he said, look, I've sent you a contract to sign and we can do a deal. And John said, look, I've looked at this contract. And I'm on behalf of my government, I just can't sign this contract. He said, you know, it's full of things that we just can't accept. And Bernie said, well, don't worry. He said, just change it a bit. And he said, cross things out and it'll be okay. And John said, look, we don't do business like that. He said, I'm going to come to London and I want to talk to you about this and negotiate. And he went with Terry and Crown Law officials and so on. Anyway, when he arrived in the office, Bernie Eccleston is a short guy, he's Jewish, he wears his braces and so on, and John looked around in the office and there were nude photos around the wall and so on in the racing industry at its worst. Eccleston said, which one's the Premier? And someone said, oh, this one over here. He said, you're a bit young, aren't you? and so they began this conversation, which went for, I think, 2 days. And eventually got a deal that we would come back, and it was embodied in legislation then here in this parliament, and so it was done properly, and it was done for the longer term, but it had an economic base to it, which is the very important thing. And Eccleston, otherwise, he would have just taken all the money and said goodbye.
And Terry tells Terry.
Interject.
Sorry, just one on that, Don. You can. Terry Plain tells a great story of that meeting, and I won't look at him in case he says you shouldn't be saying this, but so they had their meeting. They came out. Terry, as the media advisor to John Bannon, gave him a few tips. Here's what I think you should be saying to the media outside, the assembled media waiting on the steps. He tried to give the same advice to Bernie, and Bernie turned around and said to Terry, yeah, thanks, son, I think I know what I'm doing. Anyway, Terry, I'm sure it was good advice. Don.
Yeah, this is one of those you've heard it here tonight statements.
We like those very much.
Benithan really wanted an air race.
Oh, yes, yes.
He was a pilot, flown in the war, and he recalled that at our centenary there was an air race. But a number of problems arose. One was back in 1936, all planes were pretty well equal. What do you do if the RAAF put in a jet alongside of a conventional sort of... So that was a problem. But the main problem was people said, what's in it for South Australians? All they would do is go down to the airport and see some planes landing. Oh, and the other thing was the Great Circle Route would have gone across part of China, and there'd been a problem there with a plane that had been shot down.
Not a good place to be shot down either, I hasten to add.
Let's have a KRS instead.
Mike, if I could just add 1.2. I think this was very much linked in with our motor vehicle manufacturing base. In those days, we had Mitsubishi.
Yep.
And remember, the board of Mitsubishi came out. They were sponsors. And General Motors Holdings. We had all the component manufacturers. We had the Birdwood Mill, the Motor Museum, and so on. So we were a motor vehicle manufacturing centre, and this fitted in to that model as well.
Well, Adelaide was a magnet. It became, in that period, certainly the first couple of years, that everyone wanted to say they'd been to a Formula One race here. Everyone from around Australia, around the world. It was glamorous. It had everything. I was lucky enough to go along myself. Chris, I'd like to ask you that economically today, do motor races, golf tournaments, do they really stack up economically, do you think, for South Australia? I won't mention trees. I won't mention trees.
You're actually asking me that question.
Yes.
Well, I don't know, and I don't think anyone else does, for quite frankly, because we're not told anything. But I don't want to get into that debate because, I'm a dinosaur and, return to the dinosaur paddock. But, these things are up for grabs. The government obviously thinks they're good. They produce economic development. We don't actually hear about the costs, don't hear about the downside. It's all gung-ho, and we're a very popular premier, and on he goes. But I'll just say this about the Bannon negotiation about the Formula One. The Bannon government was very receptive to the idea when it came up, not just from Kim Van Eithen, but there was a fellow called Cox, I think, who was behind the suggestion. We took it up, and the Grand Prix is indicative of how good a negotiator John Bannon was. He was superb. He secured the project. He saw it as, let's not do the visionary thing. We want economic development. We want to put our Adelaide on the map. This was part of it. He did the deal with Bernie Eccleston. It wouldn't have left Adelaide if John had stayed, because that was never going to be the case. But that was an aspect of John. He was a superb negotiator, which we also saw when you'll probably come to it, the getting of the submarines here as well. Now, for the current government, which they don't usually recognise, there would be no submarines and there would be no motor racing around the streets of Adelaide if it hadn't been for John Bannon. Chris, now, some people...
Chris, don't go away, because we're moving on to submarines, so stay there, don't get comfortable. It was the other big ticket item, I think, as the 80s progressed. Bannon aggressively lobbied the feds to build the submarines locally rather than importing them. He notably proved the state's capability by being lowered, from memory, on a Navy helicopter into a surfacing submarine in 1985 to launch the audacious SA bid. Thinking about cameras all the time, that's what you had to do. Bannon and then PM Bob Hawke officially opened ASC North facility in Osborne in SA. Chris, just on that, an amazing feat to pull that off, given when I say, and this isn't patronisingly, little old Adelaide, we've done the Grand Prix, other things, but an amazing feat, which is still benefiting South Australia today, and if all goes well, for decades, a century to come.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I think it's very important to start with the Hawke government and Kim Beazley as Defence Minister. It was their decision. They wanted to build submarines, industrial capacity within Australia rather than buy them off the shelf from somewhere else. So that was the core decision that was taken. The issue then was, where would it be? And some people perhaps just imagine now that it landed, by luck in South Australia. It did not. We had to put together a submarine task force, which was managed by John Bannon, and we had to convince the federal government against competition, as I remember it. Chris Schott was here. He will remember where they were. Western Australia, I think, were in for it big time. New South Wales, and Kim Beazley was a member in Western Australia. Bear this in mind. New South Wales were in for it. we had to put up the best case. And we put up the best case and we convinced the federal government to locate the Collins-class submarines here in Adelaide. Now, that was because of the capacity of John Bannon as a negotiator.
Thank you, Chris. Don Hopgood, just following on from that, was it a combination of vulnerability to manufacturing designs and a desire to be part of a growing high-tech boom back in the 80s? A bit of both. Could we almost see manufacturing decline? I know it was a long time coming. Was that part of the desire to get submarines, just in case we needed them?
Well, I think we wanted to try to maintain as much of our manufacturing base as we possibly could. Because, as you say, there was a decline over the whole of Australia in local manufacturing, and the more that we could do to get it, the better. One of the problems, of course, about attracting industry is that, of course, all the states tend to compete against each other. And this is a problem. And what this does is it raises the price that you have to pay to get the facility in. Whereas if the states all got together and said, well, this is your turn and this is your turn, this is your turn, maybe it'd be a little bit easier.
So, yes. Yep, sure.
I mean, the critical thing that happened at this time was we moved from a protection economy that was protected, tariffs, government assistance, Playford, you know, was brilliant at it, built up industries behind high tariff walls, heavily protected, and we moved into a period of neoliberalism, economic rationalism, whatever you want to call it, and it didn't matter whether it was, Thatcher in the UK or Reagan or wherever it was, or the Hawke-Keating government in South Australia, started by the Whitlam government, actually, in reducing tariffs. So the environment about industrial development had completely changed, and we had to try to get those industries going in South Australia, including submarines, the car plant and other things. And everyone was trying to maintain an industrial base in circumstances where the economic paradigm for that time had changed dramatically.
Thank you, Chris. Greg Crafter, it's a similar story to Olympic Dam in a way. It is casting the net, being successful, and this isn't just a one-hit wonder. Submarines, well, Collins class now have to be complete almost a renovation to them to keep them operable until the AUKUS submarines arrive. Do you think John Bannon envisaged back in those days just how long-lasting and how futuristic this would become?
Yeah, John Bannon was a student of history, and I think that played a part in this decision-making. And also, throughout his career, really, and certainly afterwards, his area of academic interest was in federalism and the Australian Constitution. And I think none of these projects, Roxby Downs or even today, can't be achieved while Steelworks, for example, without a cooperation between the states and the Commonwealth, or this state and the Commonwealth. And John was masterly at negotiating with the Commonwealth on these major projects, complex projects, and winning them on merit, not on political basis. And we need to remember, with respect to defence industries, most of Australia's defence research has been done for a very long time at Salisbury. It's one of the largest operations in research in this country, and they've done brilliant work there. But also, we've got the Woomera rocket range, we've got the satellite tracking networks that are so important to the US, of course, in this country, and some of them are located here in South Australia. And so we've got a history of really important defence installations here. And so it's based on that as well that we've got this other network of shipbuilding and so on, much of which needs research behind it and innovation. And I think that's what John's thinking was.
We've talked about the hits, of which so far there have been many. The multifunction polis. Was that something that everyone sat around and said? I know it wasn't. John Bannon supported it. It wasn't initiated, so to speak. But is that one of the big clangers that this state has ever tried to achieve, and was it ever going to achieve much? I'll start with you, Greg, so we're down there.
I think the problem with the multifunction polis is that it was really a thought bubble that came from the Japanese and from the federal government, and it was almost imposed on us. The board itself was really a board that was dominated by appointments from the Commonwealth. And, Chair died Lou Edwards, I think, you know, who's a former Deputy Premier of Queensland. And so we had a bit part in it, rather than growing it up from the bottom. That area of Adelaide is still pretty barren and available for development, and it's now proved very difficult to develop that land. But it will be developed, of course, one day. But I think they might have found that it was almost impossible to build that sort of facility there.
Don, do you regret any part of being involved in this? And we've heard from countless leaders since then, the money that was wasted at the time.
It wasn't a huge amount of money wasted. It could have been.
It was by those terms, wasn't it, those days?
No. Feds. I think probably we got out from under before it got too embarrassing. There was one spin-off, and that is to tertiary education out the north. It did get a bit of a fillip from what we'd done in the multi-function polis stuff.
Yep. Chris, sorry to get you up again. Just on that, when you were sitting around Cabinet, was John Bannon, did he feel awkward about when the MFP was going through its dying stages?
I got a bit of a different take on this, because the MFP, its name or whatever, it ended up, with a bad name, a bit like the one-way freeway down to Noarlunga, what the Liberals got stuck with. Good idea, an economic thing to do. But governments look for development. Governments look for money to be brought into the state for, a whole lot of things. We've just heard about Grand Prix, submarines, etc. What happened with the multifunction polis is this. It was a proposal that emerged, a proper proposal, from the relevant department in Japan. They approached the federal government and said, we want to get together and cooperate with Australia to produce a futuristic city, if you like, housing and high-tech industry, etc. That was where it all began. Now, we didn't think we had and so states bid for it. We didn't think we had much of a chance, but we said, we'll throw in a bid. And Queensland was obviously the place they wanted to go to. Well, that soon got cancelled because the locals put up signs saying, no Jap cities in Queensland. And so, naturally, the Japanese supporters of this, who were putting a lot of money into it, they weren't too enthusiastic about that. So they moved to Victoria. Well, Victoria didn't want to have a bar of it either. The unions didn't like the idea of this multi-funk for various reasons. So that got scrapped, and we're just sort of tagging along at the end. And we're given the opportunity of federal money, to establish this multifunction polis, this futuristic city. And we took it on. And again, it was a plus in negotiations that we actually, were in there anywhere. We shouldn't have been, because it should have been in the Gold Coast. But Jap City, no good. Unions in Victoria, no. So we got it. And it was a good thing to get at the time. Now, over time, it got a bad name. I don't think we've spent a lot of money on it, because a lot of the money actually initially was from the federal government. But eventually, Gilman was obviously not the Gold Coast, so I think the Japanese lost a bit of interest. Over time, the federal government lost interest, so the federal funding, Japanese funding, stopped for it, and we had to close it down, and there was some legacy buildings left. So I think it was something that was worth having a go for, foreign money, federal money, a new concept, but in the end it failed. But I'm more positive about why we got into it in the first place.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to the Adelaide Casino. I think the casino opened in December 1985, the licence being held by the State-owned Lotteries Commission, which appointed a private operator, originally consisting of 89 gaming tables, and in 1993 to operate poker machines, By 1997, there were a total of 674 machines. But, Don, the casino set Adelaide on a new path, didn't it? Again, given your background, not sure you would have been in there pulling the pokey handles too often.
Well, I voted against it.
Yes.
And Lynn Arnold voted against it. You voted against it. Or did you?
Yeah, I think I did.
Yeah, yeah.
Did anyone who voted for it?
And some of the Liberals voted.
Everyone did now, that's for sure.
Some of the Liberals voted for it. Yeah. But, I mean, given my background, you shouldn't be surprised that I was opposed to this, where people who couldn't afford it would lose their money. Now, I still wander into pokey parlours from time to time, usually a shortcut to the toilet. And I look at these people and think, you've got nothing else to do with your time, let alone your money. So I was opposed to it, but I can see some of the benefits that have come.
Greg, Don has just indicated that you voted against it, which do you remember if you did or not?
Yeah, no, I don't.
Let's assume you did.
I'm pretty sure I did, yeah.
But it's a real long-term problem of gambling addiction. Was that ever considered by Cabinet at the time?
Oh, yes, there's no doubt.
Just yeah. Into the microphone a bit, Greg.
Yeah. Guess we'd be careful what I say about Cabinet discussions.
Oh, I think we've passed a bit of time
there
now.
Was,
you're in a safe place here.
This was a matter that was debated, you know, to a great deal. The reality is there's always been very substantial gambling in society in this country. We're a great gambling country. And some of it's legal and a lot of it in those days was illegal. And as racing minister at one stage, I was faced with the problem of SP betting. And we actually allowed on-course betting through telephone so that we could actually gather tax from it, but also that we could eliminate SP betting, because then there was prostitution and money laundering and so on moving through that SP betting circle coming out of a Royal Commission in Queensland. So, you know, there is an issue about how do you manage gambling. And there was a lot of competition in Australia about, you know, casinos are emerging. So, you know, I think that was the context of the debate at that time, similarly with poker machines.
Do you think, given Formula One, John Bannon being the person he was he and Adelaide and South Australia a bit swept up in this glitzy Monte Carlo-style vibe, I guess? Was that part of the reason to get ahead of the game with casinos?
No, I don't think so. I think there was a revenue issue there. And it was also that a lot of our gambling tourism was going interstate. And, you know, in poker machines, people were going up to the Riverland and so on. You could go on buses and so on. And so, you know, can you, you know, continue to hold the line on that? I had discussions with John about this. We both voted eventually for poker machines. And, you know, I think there's the debate on poker machines is still a pretty live one, you know, whether they're... And I think they're losing a lot of their popularity to a large extent anyway.
To online gambling?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, one thing leads to another, you might say. But, Don, is that a good enough argument that someone else will get the revenue from poker machines if we don't jump in? Was that the thought at the time, as Greg is saying? If you can just lean in a bit.
I wasn't very much persuaded by that argument, I've got to say. The other thing I wanted to mention was that did we not set up some sort of fund to assist those groups that were trying to do work with problem gamblers? I'm sure we did. Because after I retired, one of my retirement projects was to chair that group for a while.
Yeah, I was on it as well at one stage.
There you go, yeah.
Mm. Okay. Chris, sorry to get you up again. I'll stop apologising in a minute. I don't want to tire you out. Was John Bannon beginning to feel, do you think, at this stage, we're getting to the mid-80s or beyond, that he had the Midas touch, that everything was just going swimmingly well? You know where this is all headed in about 5 minutes' time?
Well, first of all, back to the casino. Dunstan wanted a casino. Tonkin wanted a casino for tourism purposes. And Tonkin had done, that's the Tonkin government, 79 to 82. So they'd done quite a bit of work on it. They'd actually started the ASA project but hadn't completed it when the Dunstan government came, Bannon government came in 82. So we had a casino, and that, and I think there were limited poker machines in the casino. What we're talking about now is the expansion of poker machines in the early 1990s, because the casino wanted to expand them. The argument was, well, why should we just leave them in the casino when clubs want them? Pubs, and then the next argument was, do we confine them to clubs? Do we include pubs? And in the end, we decided to do them all. Now, there are clearly arguments about the issue of gambling at the moment, and I think it's time we took some action about the excessive gambling. But it was a conscience vote in the Parliament. So that meant that you were not bound by the party whip on it. And that applied in the casino, the establishment initially, by John Bannon in the early 80s, as well as the poker machine debate. And some people, Liberals supported it, opposed it, Labor supported it, opposed it, but it was a conscience vote. And some people, including the Deputy Premier at the time, Frank Blevins, had a principled view about this, that it was a matter of individual freedom. You know, if you wanted to gamble, then you're entitled to gamble. Now, there's a downside to that, which we now know about. But there were principled debates. There were debates about the issue of whether we were losing the tourist dollar, and I think there's some argument that we were. People were piling into buses and heading up to Broken Hill. So it was quite a complex argument, but I don't think that John was... you've asked a slightly different question, I know, but that's on the gambling issue and how it came about. Casino we got, expansion of poker machines we also got. And to be fair, the pubs in Adelaide in the early 1990s were pretty grotty, I don't know, some of them. And poker machine revenue really did improve a lot of hospitality venues. So it wasn't all negative. Now, the question was slightly different.
Sorry. It was, Chris, but don't go away. I've got another one for you. And this is for those who have a heritage feel. Looking back, was there anything else other than the beloved railway station building where the casino could have been? I know that you can't remember. Was it ever discussed anywhere else?
Yep.
Greg?
There was discussions about it going into some rural areas, you know, out of the city. And I think Victor Harbour was one that was discussed, and Ayers House was another one,
yep,
and so on. But, you know, the railways building turned out to be, you know, absolutely the right decision. Its location and it's then part of that ACER development and all that went around that as well.
So looking at that, Greg, by today's standards, and I was around, it was actually the first story I ever did at Channel 10 in 1985, the 21st of January 1985, and it was a Monday, if anyone wants to look it up. Gee, I hope I'm right. And I was sent down to do the start of this wonderful new project, the ACER development, and they were starting work at Adelaide Railway Station, and looking at the plans, I just could not believe. I thought, this will never happen, the development. Taj Mahal proportions. Is that one of our great achievements, being able to do what we did in the station surrounds? And I include the then Hyatt Hotel, now the Intercon?
Yeah. Well, I think there was certainly plenty of community discussion about it, but it's built over the railway lines, you know, so it didn't have the issues, I think, that this building behind here has. And but it was handled well. Glenn Murcutt, the architect, did that government tower building. It was changed around. It was going to be high and was reduced down to scale and so on. And the colours of the buildings and so on, I remember debates about them. But the location of the Hyatt Hotel, the government tower, then the potential for, you know, the convention centre and all of that flowed nicely along North Terrace's public buildings.
Yeah. Yes, Don.
Well, Jeff Virgo brought a model into the cabinet about 1975 about the use of the airspace over the Adelaide Railway Station. So it wasn't something completely new. And the other thing, of course, is from right the Webb, of course, built the railway station, 1926 or 27. And at the time, it was Italianate, it was modern, it was all that sort of thing. So it was something worth building on.
I remember the Riverside complex, for those, is basically next door. And Mick Atkinson might be able to help me out with this. Ron Owen, was he the... Yep. The General Secretary, who everyone feared during his time. I don't know why. He was quite a nice guy in the end. And I remember we were filming a building that was absolutely... It was being enveloped by industrial trouble. And he said, hey, Sonny, you got the wrong building. It's the one next door. So I just remember Ron. I thought, well, he's a nice enough guy. He's told me we got the wrong building. But anyway, the REM Centre as well. It, to me, that is the Myer Centre that we know now. It's been the home of government offices. John Olsen's office was there for a while because he didn't want to be at state admin for some reason. I know why, but I won't say. But he, that building was just seemed to be that lavish largesse of the 80s that didn't quite go right in terms of costing and what the State Bank was exposed to it. I'd like to hear from all three of you what you thought of that development. Was it worth doing?
Can I just say something about John Bannon's in sort of philosophy, if you like, with respect to these very important located buildings? And John, I think, commented many times about the constitutional propriety of keeping the executive arm of government around Victoria Square. It's where in the Treasury building, where the Playford cabinet met, in state administration, where Dunstan government met, and so on. And the movement of the cabinet office and the Premier's office to North Terrace, he saw as breaching those constitutional proprieties, because we had the Parliament on North Terrace, we had the courts in Victoria Square, and under separation of powers, you need a geographical, if you like, a visual separation of powers in our community as well. And I think he would have been very concerned as well about these buildings at the back, because it's about respect for this institution, which is fundamental to our state and our quality of life here. And so visually, we need to respect this space of Parliament itself.
What do you think of the buildings out the back, or the one and the one on the way?
Don't ask me.
Right, I won't.
But I think there is this constitutional nicety that has some real substance to it. And these buildings along North Terrace, you know, we're not going to build behind the university or any of these other art gallery. These are important institutions, and Parliament is the most important of all for good governments and well-being of our state.
Greg, you've got no argument from me on that one at all. Don, again, the glamour and the money and the, as I said, largesse of the 80s, that Myer Centre, to me, stands out as, A, one of the ugliest buildings I've ever seen, and B, one of the most expensive buildings, value for money, that I've ever seen. What was the thought at the time?
Well, I can't remember. What? Too long ago. However, I will say this. despite what I said earlier,
it was only 40 years.
What I said earlier about John and all the support for the green stuff, including the metropolitan and city stuff, he loved development. I remember him saying, "Oh, I like to see cranes in the air. That's the important. It means that things are happening."
We've got a premier that does that now. No, that's not a criticism. He loves talking about cranes. Chris, have you got? Can you remember back to those heady days?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think the REM building was the greatest architectural specimen in South Australia's history, but it's not that bad as a functioning retail area. I wouldn't argue about that. The problem was it didn't stack up economically, and that brings you back into the bank, and it was a development that had to happen. The investment that was put into it did not get a return, and that then found its way through the problems with the State Bank. But as a building, I don't particularly like it, but it wasn't the worst building in the world. We needed a development there. We proceeded with it. It was supposed to be an economic proposition. This was Roy Bannon's instructions. Got to stack up commercially. as we know now from State Bank issues, it didn't stack up commercially, and it was one of the things that went into the State Bank deficit pile.
Thank you very much, Chris. Now, we're winding up with one last topic. You can probably guess what it is. That, and I know ASPG has already trawled over the State Bank in the past, but we can't discuss the Bannon decade or the 80s without a brief revisit. The State Bank disaster, with the government as owner, guarantor to the $3 billion loans, saw Bannon face three inquiries, with the last two clearing him of any wrongdoing. He resigned as Premier on the 4th of September 1992. In fact, I was there at the media conference, which I'd have to say, three words sum it up: sombre, sad, and this is not a word, a phrase seemingly aligned in the sand moment for all the good and bad times that we'd seen in politics that decade. Bannon didn't recontest his seat at 1993. An AFR report at the time said, John Bannon had told his Treasury Department he did not wish to be made formally aware of the bank's performance and would rather gain his information directly from the bank. The combination of Tim Marcus Clark, his dominant personality and a lack of banking experience on the State Bank SA board proved to be lethal. Premier Bannon was mesmerised by Marcus Clark. He accepted his assurances that everything was running smoothly, even though the bank was dancing on the lip of a financial volcano. I'll put it to all of you.
Where was that quote from?
The Financial Review. Can I ask all of you who were there at the time, who knew what and when in the lead-up to the bank's woes becoming public? Silence.
Well, can I just say, all I was aware of is there'd been some questions in the House. And that was all. That was all. I went to a conference in New Zealand. I came back, sat in the cabinet room. There were one or two statements made, and I thought, what are they talking about? And I turned to Frank Blevins. I said, what's going on? And he told me. And that was the first I really knew. So I'm really not the one to answer.
So, but, Don, weren't the questions in the House? Normally questions come up from an opposition when they know the answer. Not always. Didn't anything start to sound an alarm bell?
No. We just thought it was a way of attacking the government. Bannon said at one stage, by way of interjection, you know, if you lot get back into power, you're not going to be inheriting much because of what you're saying.
Because he feared a run on the bank.
Yeah, that's right.
Greg?
I don't think I can add any more comment than that. You know, I'm in the same position as Don. I didn't become aware of it until, and it was a huge shock to John briefed us in Cabinet and said, look, this is what I've discovered about the finances of the bank. I should just go on to say, I think it did take a terrible toll on John,
who
accepted the responsibility. We couldn't interfere in the bank by statutory requirements, but we did appoint the board, and I think that we should have taken some people off the board who were there, long-term appointments. There are issues around that. But the criticism that John received after he'd left Parliament was really very, very sad, and people just were ignorant, really, of what did go on, you know, given the coverage at that time, and people were obviously very, very upset about it. But I think John's career should be judged in the light of his whole life experience, and he'll be well judged for the good person that he was. And I must say that I wrote, when he said he was resigning, I wrote a letter and offered my resignation as well. And I thought that we should have all resigned and gone to an election. But John talked me out of that and said, you've got to stay and fight and do what you can to help this government. And remember, John fought afterwards two budgets to restore some substance to the bank. And the reality was that John's prudent management as treasurer over that decade had allowed this state to have the resources to withstand that sort of impact on the bank itself. He had money hidden away in lots of places. Of course, when the day that that was announced publicly, we thought there was going to be a run on the bank, and so there was a lot of support from the other banks to ensure that that didn't happen. But John's career after he left the bank, albeit a very short one, indicated just the substance of the man.
Chris, would you like to have the last word? This is literally the last word on the Bannon 80s.
Yes, well, we were supposed to have dealt with the bank 2 years ago in another one of these sessions with Lynn Arnold and Dean Brown, but I guess we can't avoid it. I agree very much with what Greg has said about the careful management of the finances from 82 through to 91 when the bank default was announced, or the problems with the bank at least wasn't actually a default. John Bannon was... they called him, his economic advisor called him a Scrooge, because he was actually incredibly careful, and this is one of the great paradoxes in the situation. He was incredibly careful with public monies. He'd travel economy class and this sort of thing. So Greg's right about that, and that did give us a little bit of room to move. But the moment the State Bank first bailout was announced, the debt went up to where it had been when we started in 1982. And, I mean, that was just terribly devastating. But he was a good financial manager up until that point. Now, how long have we got to delve into the bank? Probably not very long. I've got a whole lot of things here I could say about it, of course. But I suppose Murphy's Law on steroids is how you can describe the bank. Anything that could go wrong did go wrong. I think a lot of checks and balances failed. I think the Bannon government was let down by a lot of people around it, and that was accepted by the Royal Commission. The structure of the Royal Commission meant that Sam Jacobs reported before the Auditor-General could report on what went on in the bowels of the bank. And John took political responsibility, but I think in terms of individual personal responsibility, he's taken greater responsibility than he should have. Now, we can go through the Auditor General. If you want to look at the bank, jump over the first two Royal Commission reports. That was the public stuff. Go into what the Auditor General found out about the management of the bank by the Managing Director Tim Marcus Clark and by the board, and it is just extraordinary reading. They did not do their job at all. Now, Marcus Clark was an inappropriate appointment in a public bank. He had conflicts of interest with the way he used the money at various times. And astonishingly, Bannon said, look, the bank's got to comply with the normal banking prudential requirements of the private sector. Now, that couldn't be imposed because the State Bank was a protected economic entity, so it couldn't be subject to Reserve Bank requirements by law. But that was the direction that was given. Now, over the Equity Court, people might know all this story, the bank behaved totally irresponsibly. Marcus Clark behaved irresponsibly, had a conflict of interest, he lost cash money, and the extraordinary thing about it is that the board backed him. The more extraordinary thing about it is that the Reserve Bank knew what was going on over that particular transaction. They were pushing the bank to get its matters in order as far as financial prudence were concerned. And the bank and Marcus Clark pushed back. The Reserve Bank did not take action. They did not let the Treasurer Bannon know that this is what was going on. They didn't let the Federal Treasurer know what was going on. And so checks and balances, that was a major failing in what should have occurred. Now, so the RBA played a role. The board, and particularly the Board of Beneficial Finance, they didn't perform their duties as directors, and the managing director didn't perform his duties properly. And the Auditor-General, his report, is the one to read. If you want to read a good book about it, Dr. Greg McCarthy, Things Fall Apart, an Adelaide academic, has written a really good book on the State Bank. And it does, give the Bannon role in it a much more better perspective. The Treasurer, the Under-Treasurer, they should have provided better advice. The auditors, I mean, the auditors were negligent. They were private auditors. That was more or less a requirement by the Liberal Party that I think Bannon agreed with. So they're private sector auditors, and we've heard of these people. Pete Marwick was one. They were auditing the State Bank of South Australia, and they are now KPMG. Now, we've heard of them, and they haven't exactly covered themselves in glory since their inglorious days badly auditing the State Bank. Beneficial Finance were Price Waterhouse. Now, we've all heard of them and their recent dodgy behaviour, but they've all gone on to greater things, but they just failed dismally as private auditors of the State Bank. One more thing, there's a number of things I could say. Well, John Bannon's nature was too trusting. I think he expected people to do the right thing, and they didn't. The one other thing which I think was almost touched on in the House, because I wasn't in the House of Assembly when all this was going on, the adversarial system of politics did not help, because the government reacted to what the opposition was saying and saw it as just purely political. And Mike Elliott, who a lot of people might remember anymore, he was an Australian Democrat member in the upper house. And when he made his speech about the State Bank, he made that point, and I think it was a very perceptive point, that adversarial politics played a role in it. Now, having said that, Jennifer Cashmore started raising the issues in mid-1989. And there's another thing in politics, which is a fundamental rule for any aspiring politician: do not believe your own, I'm sorry, you know what I'm going to say, BS. Fundamental rule. We unfortunately believed our own BS because we did not start looking at some of the issues that Jennifer Cashmore and others were raising, and we have to take responsibility of that. There's no way out of it. But I think while we took political responsibility properly, and John took responsibility, stayed on, sorted out the bank, or tried as best as he could, I think his personal individual responsibility was not as great as a lot of people have made it out to be, but there's no doubt that obviously it's a major issue and a major disaster for the state. But the reason it occurred is for a whole complex of reasons, where people did not do their job, the government was let down. Read the work on the board, on the Auditor's General report on the board, and on the behaviour of the directors, who went to the Royal Commission, by the way, with taxpayers' money, trying to defend the indefensible, namely that it had nothing to do with them. Well, common sense tells you that that's just rubbish. And just one final point. When we had to set up a Royal Commission, JP Morgan had done the assessment of the bank at that time, and, you know, we had to have the Royal Commission politically. But I was asked to see the JP Morgan fellow to see whether he, get some comments on the Royal Commission and its conduct. And he said, well, it's not going to be a great idea having a Royal Commission while you're trying to run an active bank. And I said, well, I understand that. We've got to have it. But he says, it's not going to find anything anyhow. He says, this will only find that this bank went down the old-fashioned way. And that's just the fact of the matter. It made loans, without adequate security, got caught up in the recession we had to have, the economic circumstance. All the banking industry was in trouble. Westpac nearly went under. Westpac at the time was chaired by Sir Eric Neill, who went on to be governor. So it was all part of that environment in which this... this occurred. So, I think it's accurate to say John was badly let down. Bannon, he was too trusting. Marcus Clark shouldn't have been in the job. The board was appalling. The auditors didn't do their job. So what we've got is a whole lot of checks and balances that didn't work. Now, there we go.
Thanks, Chris. Well, there you go.
Well said, sir. Well said.
Well done. Well done, Chris.
I think we all know a lot more about what was going on in the corridors of power at the time. Ladies and gentlemen, this is where we leave the Bannon decade. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to walk through this momentous time in the state's history. It turns back the clock for all of us, I'm sure. All of us. I don't think this first young lady here. No, she wasn't here. We're all part of it, and in many cases owned a part of this period. It's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege. I'll hand you back to Josh Teague. Thanks, Josh.
Well, I think, as I think we might have hoped at the outset, we've had in many ways refreshing, enlightening, and challenging last hour and a half. And one personal reflection as a present member of this place, to hear the advocacy, the voice coming through, partly of an era of 40 more years ago, but right up to now, the earnestness, the freshness of your sincerely held views, all three of you, some might say, of course, but it's, I think, and I hope, appreciated by everyone here, that you've given such a thoroughgoing and spirited view of your recollection of those times, and I think carrying through your present values to this day. Another round of applause. And I think that wasn't going to happen nearly so fluently or comprehensively without that expert management of tonight's event by Mike Smithson, who we might all agree, the great, not so much the necessarily only the veteran, the great Mike Smithson. A round of applause for Mike as well. Now, Shane's going to help me. I have something to give to each of our panellists and to Mike tonight. So I'll do that as we close. And can I again say, tonight's a public and free event. The ASPG is active throughout the year, and you're very much encouraged to follow its progress and to join up as a member of the ASPG. Come along, come back to Parliament, stay engaged with all of the activities that ASPG is seeking to advance. Thanks very much, everybody, for your presence here tonight. Again, one final round of applause for everybody.
Thank you very much.